Grab a seat, everybody. How are we today? Beautiful. I am just now, it hit me about middle of this week. I'm starting to get into the Christmas spirit. I didn't for a while, and I wanted it to come. It just wasn't happening for me. I'm trying, you know? So finally, I'm driving home, and it's a little chillier because it's not 80 degrees for the first time in a while. And I'm driving back to Dallas, and it's nighttime, and I finally did it. Every year, I put on the best Christmas album to start my holiday cheer, and it's Boys and Men Christmas Interpretations. And you can laugh and you can argue, but you'll lose and you're wrong. Anyway, so I put that on, then I'm driving home and it finally hit me like Christmas is here. And I'm excited now. I'm excited for our services next weekend, for the 11 o'clock service, for all the people that are going to fall asleep while I'm teaching. It's going to be so good, guys. I'm excited for this series we're doing. And if you're new to this series, we started it last week. And we're going to be kind of all over our Bibles today. We're talking about the idea of God's timing. And the incarnation, Jesus coming here, why it happened, when it happened. And there are different kinds of sermons. Let me set an expectation for today, okay? There are different kinds of sermons you're going to hear in a church. You have like the really upbeat, God is good, he's working for your good, all the heartstrings and emotions are pulled in the right way, and you leave feeling like just amazing on a Sunday morning. You almost skip to your car and be like, God is good. I trust him. This is awesome, right? That's one type of sermon. You also have the kind of Baptist Catholic model, which is a little more shame-based, which you're going to leave feeling pretty bad about yourself, but God is awesome, all right? You got that model. Today's going to be a little different. Today's model, sometimes there's just kind of a time we need to have more of a lecture, like college format-ish. And it's kind of what today is. It's more lecture. We're going to be in a lot of history today. And so some of you are thinking, yes. And some of you are thinking, is it dark enough to walk out? But that's okay. All right. History is good, I promise. A lot of first century influences. What we're going to do today is try to answer the question, why in the world did Jesus come when he came? In the history and the scope of humanity, why did Jesus come when he came? Because we have this verse that our series is based off of. It's in Galatians chapter 4. Goes like this. But when the fullness of time came, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law, so that he might redeem those who were under the law, that we might receive the adoption as sons. So lines 2 through 5 there are really the why he came, to redeem, to transfer us into his kingdom, all the beautiful things we talk about. That first phrase, that first line, but when the fullness of time came, talks about the when. And really our conversation is about the timing of God. Why God does what he does when he does. Why do we trust his timing? I grew up playing baseball, and so when I think of timing, I think of baseball because it is a really important facet of the game sometimes you miss. Most athletes will tell you that the hardest thing to do in all of sports is to hit a baseball. Because you can be as strong as you want, but if you don't make contact, it's not going anywhere. And if a ball's thrown at 90 miles an hour, you have 0.4 seconds to react by the time it leaves the pitcher's hand and hits the catcher's mitt. In that 0.4 second, you gotta find where the ball is, because there's always different release points. You gotta pick up the spin on the ball to see what it's gonna do between the pitcher's hand and the catcher's mitt. And then you gotta decide if you wanna swing and then where you're gonna swing. 0.4 seconds, right? I grew up playing baseball and I got to high school and I had a new baseball coach. His name was Andy Postema, great guy. And I remember I get there and he starts tinkering with my swing because it's all about timing, right? So little things like they teach you when the pitcher puts his left foot down, that's when you pick your first foot up. And he started telling me to not move so quickly. And I'm thinking, who is this guy? I played baseball for a long time. And I knew that he played pro ball, but that didn't mean anything to me because I was 14 and I was going to conquer the world. And so he'd tell me, like, Charlie, don't lean forward, because when a pitch is coming at you and you play baseball, you want to get ready and kind of lean into it a little bit, right? And he would tell me over and over again, we'd do these drills, and he'd make you stand like this, put the bat right here, and he'd throw balls at you, and at any given point in your swing, he'd just say, drop your bat. And even if you were here, like about to swing, he'd make you drop your bat and had to land behind your back right foot. And there were so many times I dropped it right on my toe, and he'd just look at me, right? And he's trying to get me to wait back, but I didn't want to. I'm an anxious kid. I'm not very patient. I like my timing, and I'd say to myself, you know what, I got this. And you'd lean forward, and I'd be out here hitting the baseball. Really, it was a battle between what he wanted and what I wanted, my trust or his. And when we talk about timing, that's really what it comes down to is, who do we trust? Why? So when we talk about this phrase, the fullness of time, when we talk about the idea of God's timing being something that might be different than our timing, it's a conversation about trust all the time. And what I love about this, sometimes I play the game, I don't know if you guys do, if I was God, I would, you know? And if you're God and you can do anything you want, I ask myself the question, with this whole idea of saving the world, of redemption that we've bought into through Jesus, why did he do it the way that he did? Like, just why? If he could do it any way he wanted, why that way? And then let's get more specific on this time of year and this verse, the fullness of time Jesus came at the right time. Why then? Why 2,000 years ago? I mean, I'm a logical guy. I'm thinking, why didn't Jesus come like today when he could have 12 million Twitter followers tomorrow instead of 12 Jewish dudes walking around following him, you know? That seems like a more efficient use of Jesus's time. I'm thinking, why would he come 2,000 years ago when he had to walk everywhere and it was filthy and he could just get on a flight and go across the world? Why did he come when there wasn't mass broadcast abilities like TV? Why then? Why didn't he come before? It's this big question of, why do I trust God's timing? Because I need to see it. I want to see it. And so today what we're going to do is really look at some first century, kind of first 100 years cultures and say, maybe there's a reason why he came when he did. But this question of timing has been one all throughout the course of human history, especially with the Jews. There's one of my favorite verses in Exodus 3. This is when Moses is out, he's shepherding his flock, and he comes up on a bush, and it's burning, but it's not being burned up, right? And he's like, this is weird. And so he stops down, and he hears a voice from the bush. Gets a little weirder. And God starts talking to him. Because at this point in Israel's history, they got moved under good conditions to Egypt, and then over time that changed, and then they became slaves. And for 400 years, God was silent. 400 years, his people begged for him to deliver them, and he just didn't do it. And ironically enough, you see a parallel between the 400 years of deliverance from the Egyptian exodus to the 400 years that God was quiet before Jesus came. We call that the intertestamental period. And so in Exodus chapter 3, God says this to Moses, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and I've given heed to their cry because of their taskmasters. For I'm aware of their suffering, so I've come down to deliver them from the power of the Egyptians and to bring them up from the land to a good and spacious land. Why I love that verse is that phrase, I've surely seen it. It's Hebrew idiom. It doesn't necessarily mean that he was looking over here and he didn't realize the kids were running amok behind him, right? It's, I've seen it, I knew it all along, I'm now finally deciding to act. It's like when you're driving, you have kids in the back seat, and you know they're fighting, but their fighting hasn't entered your sphere yet a little bit, and then they start kicking the back of your chair, and you're like, I will turn this car around right now. You decide to act, right? Exodus chapter 3 is God saying, this is my time to deliver my people. I know it's been going on, but now I act. Same parallel to what's happening when Jesus comes. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at three cultures. We're going to look at the Jewish culture, we're going to look at the Roman culture, and we're going to look at the Greek culture that all had influences on the first century world. And we're going to ask the question, why did God send Jesus then? Why not before? Why not after? Why not now? Why does it make sense? So let's start with the Jews. First thing we have to know about the Jewish culture is they gave the world something. The Jews gave the world the expectation of deliverance. And I know Steve did a good job last week of talking about the faith of the people in a deliverer. He went through Hebrews 11 and talked about how faith is when we make risky decisions based on things that others don't see but we believe to be true. And so he walked through this passage and said, this is what faith looks like from these people. And the whole Jewish faith is really based on this supposed deliverance in the future. But in the first century world, it's a little bigger than just, we hope this happens at some point in my life. It gets a little more specific. And so we're going to do, if you've got a Bible, go to Daniel chapter 9. We're going to be in two verses for a couple minutes. And what happens in Daniel chapter 9 is we enter the world of prophecy, of God telling one of his prophets things that are going to happen in the future. And what this is going to do is kind of not just say they expected to deliver at some point, but it's going to specify at which point the deliverer is going to come. So we're in chapter 9, verse 24, and to build up to this point, Israel had this history of like being good with God and then not being oppressed and then forgetting God and getting taken over by people. And it went wave after wave after wave. This is the story of the Old Testament, of them forgetting God and then being ruled by somebody else. And in Daniel, his whole story is about the Babylonian exile. So they one time forgot God, and they were completely taken over by another country. Daniel's one of the first people to get enslaved. And he worked his way up to prime minister and a chief magi and a wise man in the land there. And this is the end of the book. And he's praying for his people that they might go back to where they came from, that God might restore their people. Jeremiah had a prophecy that said 70 years later, and we're coming up kind of on that time. And so he's praying for him. And Gabriel, the angel, visits Daniel and says these words to him. 70 weeks have been determined concerning your people and your holy city to put an end to rebellion, to bring sin to completion, to atone for iniquity, to bring in perpetual righteousness, to seal up the prophetic vision, and to anoint a most holy place. First thing we have to realize is this is not talking about then, nor is it talking about now. When you see words like, it's going to bring an end to rebellion, bring sin to a completion, it is not complete yet, believe me, I read the news, right? It's going to bring sin to a completion, to atone for iniquity, to bring in perpetual righteousness, and this is it, to seal up the prophetic vision. This is talking about the very end when Jesus comes back and puts a bow on his plan to redeem and restore. It's saying 70 weeks it's going to take. Now we got to ask the question, how long are these weeks? 70 weeks, actually, the word weeks there in Hebrew means sevenths. And there's two ways you can interpret it. You can interpret it as days or years. So what we either have is 77 day periods or 77 year periods. And they're both okay. We see it in the idea, in the expression of Sabbath in the Jewish culture. Every 7 days, they take a Sabbath, and that's a day interpretation of what that means. Also, every seven-year period, every 49 years, they take a bigger Sabbath called the Year of Jubilee, and they rest for the entire year, and they free slaves, and they don't plant stuff so the soil can heal. It's a bigger expression of rest, which means we trust in God, we put our faith in God to provide. And so when he's talking about 77 here, what do you mean 77-year periods here, we know it's years based on the context. In the first verse in this chapter, he's talking about the 70 years that which they were in captivity. And so what we do, and we can spend a whole lot of time on this, but we don't have time today. We just want to get the big picture. He's saying that after 77-year periods, you're going to find redemption. Like the world is going to find redemption. And he goes into more specifics in the next verse, in 25. He said, so know and understand. From the issuing of the command to restore and rebuild Jerusalem. So he starts big picture and then he focuses on Israel. From the issuing of the command to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until an appointed one, a prince arrives, that's Jesus, there'll be a period of 7 weeks and 62 weeks. So seven-year periods and 62 seven-year periods. Yay, math, everybody, right? So after these periods, that's 69 seven-year periods, it will again be built. Let's talk about the city of Jerusalem. After 69 seven-year periods, what he's saying is there will come an anointed one, and the city of Jerusalem will be restored in some way. And so then we have to ask the question, if we know how long, when do we start counting from? Was it from yesterday? Was it from 2 years ago? It says, from the issuing of the command to restore and rebuild Jerusalem, that came by Xerxes in 444 BC. When he finally said to Israel, who was in captivity by Babylon, go home, build your city again, build your walls and live there. We don't need you here anymore. Go. So we got a little chart for you because some of us are visual learners. It's moderately blurry. We have the 7 weeks, which is 49. So it said seven sevens and then 42 sevens. 62 sevens. The first 7 weeks or 7 years, the 49 years is how long it took him to rebuild the temple. And then from there, you had 62 groupings of 7 years, 434 years. I say all this not to confuse us. I say all this not to make our heads spin. I say all this to show you that if you were a Jew in that time, you didn't randomly pick a time when you thought the Messiah might come. They counted down to something. They had a window. They had a window which they thought, oh, wait, if I do the math right, this is when God promised Jesus would come. It wasn't just a hope and a prayer, maybe one day cross my fingers, I'll meet Mr. Right kind of sort of situation. It was very specific, and it targeted the time in which Jesus came. So I went to Bible college, and Bible college does some things to a person, mostly good, I hope. And one of them, though, is it changes how I saw dating. I was in high school and I dated a couple times and dating was fun and dating was an adventure and dating was awkward, all the things it should be. I went to Bible college and dating was much more serious. I didn't really grow up in a super churchy culture, but you go to Bible college, and from the time you step on campus there, they teach you this is when you find your spouse. You got 4 years. This is a target-rich environment of Christians. You better lock it up here, because you're about to go out there, and God knows what you'll find, right? Literally, I lived on the 17th floor, and as I looked down in the plaza in our little courtyard, they had two, like, planter section areas of grass, and it literally spelt, I do. Yay, Moody. I don't know if they meant to do that or not, but it did, right? And what that mattered was, I have a lot of friends of mine that were girls in high school, and then I went to college, and if somebody saw me talking to a girl or getting coffee with a girl, it had way different connotations than we're just friends. You get the whole wink, wink, nudge, nudge, Charlie, what do you think about that one? I'm like, oh, I'm not ready to get married for a long time. But the expectation was, it's here, it's happening now, you got 4 years, look for it, right? Okay, that's the culture of the Jewish people in the first century. They had a window given to them by Daniel through Gabriel. It was prophecy they held too quickly, they were counting it down. It wasn't someday this is gonna come. So when you see scriptures in the New Testament like John 1, it takes on kind of a new meaning. In John 1, you have John the Baptist rising up, doing some crazy things, eating some bugs and baptizing some people. He's weird and he's different. He has a following. And naturally, the people of Israel were thinking, okay, a savior's going to come. We got to be on the lookout. So they corner John and they say, now, this was John's testimony when the Jewish leaders sent priests and Levites from Jerusalem to ask him, who are you? The elite sent delegates to corner John and say, hey, who are you? Implication, are you the Messiah? John's response, he confessed, he did not deny, but confessed, I am not the Christ. He had to convince these people that he wasn't the one they've been waiting for, because there's this window, there's this time, there's this place of expectation, and it's happening right now in the first century. And you carry that forward, John's asking the same question too. Look at Luke 7. When the men came to Jesus, they said, John the Baptist has sent us to you to ask, are you the one who is to come, or should we look for another? John sends delegates to Jesus because he heard about what Jesus is doing, and he said to him, hey, are you the Messiah? There is this built expectation in their culture of Messiah, and there is a small window from which that was going to happen. So I'm asking the question, why did God send Jesus when he did? Why not now? Because it wouldn't have lined up with the prophecy. And it wasn't just prophetic, like, hey, this is going to happen one day, like the second coming, when I do not know. It was very specific to a time and to a place. And they knew it. It also helps that the Jewish people, in every sense of the word, knew they needed a savior. Doesn't do a whole lot of good if you send a deliverer to people who don't need to be delivered. And when we look at the story of the Jewish people in the Old Testament, it's this constant rise and fall and rise and fall, and we think we can do it on our own. No, we can't. Over and over and over again. And then what happened was they went back and restored Jerusalem, and they got taken over again by the Greeks and then by the Romans. And that's when we enter this 400-year period of silence, this intertestamental period. There's this really awful event that happened in 167 BC where Rome came in and kind of desecrated the temple, everything they held dear. And so what happened after that was the Jews kept trying to fight. You have two revolts, the Maccabean revolts, and they would say, well, we're done with this. We're going to take back our land because God gave it to us. And they mounted up some kind of force to try and take back what was theirs. And every once in a while, it worked for a day or two or maybe 2 or 3 months, but then they'd fail. That's where we get Hanukkah from, by the way. One of the Maccabean revolts, they actually took back the temple, which was kind of like their nucleus, which stood for who they were as a people. And so they took back the temple, and there's a Jewish law that states when you take back the temple, if you have the temple, there has to be a lamp burning 24/7. But they only had oil enough for one day, and they lit this flame, and they thought it was going to burn out. But for some reason, one day's worth of oil lasted 8 days until they could find more oil. And that's why there's 8 days in Hanukkah. They celebrate that miracle of them recapturing their property and their identity. But then it got worse. After those revolts failed, it got darker and darker for the Jewish people. And they knew that they needed outside help because this wasn't working for them. One historian put it like this. He said, the Jews, however, were despondent. Once again, they were conquered, oppressed, and polluted. Hope was running low. Faith was even lower. They were convinced that now the only thing that could save them and their faith was the appearance of the Messiah. It's this idea that they finally knew they needed it. I don't watch a ton of TV, but one of the shows that I do like is a show called Kitchen Nightmares. I know that sounds really weird, but I like it for a couple reasons. One, I love food. Two, I like taking pleasure in others' pain. Three, we all do if you're honest with yourself. God's working on it. Three, it's this British guy that is actually more blunt and crass than me, and that is hard to find, everybody. So I'm like, yes, he says what I think. You know, it's so good. And I'm watching it, and what I'm amazed by every time I watch this show is that you have this restaurant that's completely failing. I mean, there's nobody in there, and you look at their food, and it's terrible. Like, you just look at it, and it looks bad. They're using microwaves, and this 3-star Michelin chef who's established an empire comes in. He eats their food, and he says, this is, and then he says some things that I'm not going to say here today, right? And then he goes back to the back, and there's usually an owner or a chef who always defends his food, always. Like, what are you talking about? This is great. And you got this chef that just left his full-time job at Chili's to work in your restaurant, and he's telling the Michelin star chef, you don't know what you're talking about, dude. My eggs be is better than yours, you know? And I love that moment, because I'm like, what is wrong with you? And the whole show is so that they can kind of show the process of these people that think there's nothing wrong when clearly there is. It's kind of the breaking point when they finally realize, oh my goodness, we need help. And we'll do anything we can to get it. That's the Jewish people in the first century. It's the breaking point when they finally said, we can't go on like this. They have an expectation of Messiah, not just because it was prophesied and they can count. They have an expectation of Messiah because they have no more morale and they need it to happen. And that expectation actually, and this is kind of one of the crazier parts, wasn't just held by them. It spread, you know, which is really interesting. Because Jesus didn't just come for the Jewish people, but other parts of the world started to pick up on this expectation of kind of a deliverer a little bit. There's a couple Roman historians that write about it. One of them, Suetonius, wrote in his book, The 12 Caesars, it's some essays, he said, there had spread over all the Orient an old and established belief that was fated at the time for men coming from Judea to rule the world. This is a Roman historian. Rome did not do well with putting other people above themselves. They were pretty prideful. And he's saying it's widely believed by people all over that somebody from the small province of Judea is going to kind of rule the world. I don't know where it's coming from, but we all kind of think that's going to happen. And then another one, he's actually a Roman senator. Tacitus said in his work, The Annals, there was a firm persuasion that at this very time, the East was to grow powerful. And rulers coming from Judea were to acquire a universal empire. Okay? Rome didn't talk like, you couldn't badmouth Rome. It was like the mafia. If you badmouth Rome, they'd beat you up, literally. And you get two people from inside the establishment saying, we've all kind of had this underlying expectation that somebody's going to come from, of all places, Judea. So what we see is not just an expectation in the Jews, even though it is, and it's deep, and it's big. We see it spread to the entire world. When else has that happened? See, this idea of expectation grow outside of just themselves. So the Jewish people brought this deep longing and expectation based on time and based on desire and need that started with them and spread out to other provinces and territories and countries. All right, so that's what the Jews brought. Let's talk about Rome for a sec. Rome gave the world peace. So I don't know if you understand how rare this was at this point, but Rome was pretty powerful. If you look at Luke 2, verse 1, it says, now in those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus. This is the beginning of the Jesus birth narrative in Bethlehem. That a census had to be taken of all the inhabited earth. Luke doesn't say of this region or that region. Luke doesn't say a census had to be taken of the Roman world. He literally said a census had to be taken of all the inhabited earth. He's saying Rome is all the inhabited earth. Rome controlled all of the UK down to Africa in modern day language. If you look at a map of current day countries that were controlled by the Roman Empire in the first century, it's about 50. You have this massive movement of freedom and of peace that has not been seen in the world since then. I mean, think about it. The countries we're talking about, I mean, you're talking about Afghanistan and Iraq and Lebanon and Syria and Jordan and Egypt and France and Portugal and Spain. When's the last time all of those people got along at the same time? When's the last time there was no war in those countries? It had not happened to that point in human history, and let me tell you something, it hasn't happened since. Pax Romana is the phrase for the Roman peace that they brought. It's Latin, and it lasted from about, give or take, 27 BC to 180 AD. It was this unique period in the history of the world where there was finally peace, and that matters. That matters because when peace comes, you can talk about other things. It matters because when Jesus came, he talked about spiritual things, and he talked about kind of what it meant to grow with the Lord. And let me tell you something. It's really hard to tell people they need Jesus if they're dying of thirst. There's a Catholic priest, and he said it like this. He said, as powerful as the message of Jesus is, there's a sense in which the spreading of this message depends on a certain amount of social order. And let me tell you how I know this to be true. I am married, okay? I sometimes give premarital counseling when people don't have anywhere else to go. And I am marrying a couple next week, and I'm excited. And so they said, Charlie, will you do my premarital counseling? I said, are you sure? And they said, yes. And I said, okay. And I was going back through my notes that I'd written on it, and I was going back through my premarital counseling book that I had with my wife a few years ago. And it's funny, they're talking about communication and conversation, how to have tough conversations. And very practical application, it said, hey, here's the deal. Tough conversations are hard. Let me give you some times in which you should not have difficult conversations. And there was an acronym, it's spelled HALT. A was when you're angry, L was when you're lost, T was when you're tired. Don't have tough conversations when you're tired. It's not gonna go well. You know what the H was? The H was hungry. They literally said hungry. I didn't get that in premarital counseling, and then I got married, and I was like, oh my, really? I can't explain it, but I know now I do not have hard conversations with my wife in the morning before breakfast, or, and this is the hard one for me, she'll come home from work sometimes, and I'll be like, let's have a chat or something, or we want to talk about something. Could just be scheduling. She needs to eat dinner, and that's okay, right? I'm realizing now that we need a certain level of social order that hunger disturbs before we have conversations about things, yeah? All right, so what I think when we talk about peace in the world is it was absolutely necessary so people could hear the message of Jesus. He goes on, this guy goes on to say, there must be some level of common civility in order for the love of Christ to be demonstrated and good news of his work to be explained. And this common civility often came through political social order. It's in his book called God and the Governing. And what I love about that is I know it to be true. It's why we take trips to build houses in Mexico when people don't have a house. It's why we do Operation Christmas Child and send gifts and you know, needs to children in Africa. Because if they're going to hear the message of Jesus, they probably need water. And so for the first time in the history of the world, we had universal peace. And it hasn't happened since. That's what Rome brought to the table. That's a big moment. They also brought something else. They brought roads. This is kind of a side note, but it's a big one. I don't know if you've ever heard the phrase, all roads lead to Rome. But if you've ever been to a country that didn't have a good infrastructure of roads, you know how frustrating that is. I was driving on the tollway yesterday, trying to get on the tollway, and for some reason they thought, you know what, let's do some construction right around a mall around the season of Christmas. And so I thought I was gonna miss some traffic. I'm coming from Andy's house to my place, and I turn left, and every entrance to the tollway was blocked, right? Every one, for like 5 miles. I sat for 45 minutes from light after light, and I'm watching people whiz by me on the tollway. It's 10 feet away, and I wanted to be over there, and I wanted to pay them to be over there, right? I'm like, let me pay you my money to drive on that road, but they wouldn't let me. Super frustrating. I lived in Guatemala for a while. Let me tell you something, man. If you drive around in some of the mountain villages there and you realize the state of the roads, you realize why things don't happen. Roads are hugely important to get messages out or supplies out. And the Romans, for the first time in the history of mankind, we're going to hear that a lot today, they built 50,000 miles of roads from the UK down to Africa. 50,000 miles. So the military could go places. And what that did, if I'm asking the question why Jesus came when he did, it's the first time in human history that after the message of Jesus started, it could actually spread and go places. That could have never happened before like it did. So Rome brought peace and Rome brought roads. Let's finish real quick and talk about the Greeks. Because these are the three major influence you have in the first century worlds. The Greeks gave the world a common culture. And when we talk about common culture, really, It's kind of interesting. They kind of took over the world right at the beginning of the intertestamental period, 360-ish BC. Alexander the Great rose up, beat down Persia, and said, let's do life our way. And where Rome ruled by military might and force, and that's what they wanted to give other people, was kind of this strong arm. The Greeks were different. The Greeks decided that what they really wanted to impart in the world wasn't fear or wasn't military might, it was culture. They were big into thought. That's why we still study Aristotle and Socrates and all those great Greek thinkers. But they also brought a language. And that's a big deal. This last year, I got the privilege of going to a few places in Europe. I went to Amsterdam, and I went to Denmark, and I went to Sweden, and I went to Albania, and I hope you're impressed. And I went to all these places. And what's amazing is I spoke English, and I didn't have a problem communicating with anybody. Do you know how outstanding that is? Because when I lived in Guatemala, I didn't speak Spanish at that point. Not the words that you want to say to people that you like. I went to high school in Texas. I learned not good things. And I remember the first summer, the summer that I was there, I went there not speaking any of it, and I would just sit there and look at people, and they would look at me and laugh, and I'm like, I didn't know what was going on, right? They were probably making fun of me. I didn't care. Really frustrating. I taught kids English. Don't ask how it happened. And I was there for an internship for school, supposed to talk about Jesus. Couldn't do it. Really frustrating to go places without a common language for the first time in the history of the world when Jesus came. Almost every country spoke Greek as well as their original language. That's why one of the first things that happened when the Greek took over was they actually translated the Old Testament into Greek, Aramaic to Greek. It's called the Septuagint. It's actually what most New Testament writers reference when they reference the Old Testament, because the New Testament's written in Greek. So for the first time in human history, you could go out, you actually get to where you're going, and you could speak a language that people understood from different parts of the world. Okay, that's phenomenal. So when we ask the question, why Jesus came, when Jesus came, ultimately what we're asking is, why do we trust God's timing over ours? Because I would have done it differently, you know? Why do we trust when he decided to deliver the Israelites in the Old Testament, and why do we trust when Jesus decided to come here? Because I can think of a lot of reasons why it should have been a different time, but what I do is I study and I look back and I realize maybe this was a really unique time in the scope of human history that hasn't been repeated since and wasn't seen before. So my coach, Postuma, in baseball, I remember the moment when I decided to trust him and like listen to him. He said, I'm gonna take BP batting practice with you guys. And we said, okay, and I was a freshman. And I remember, I think our best pitcher was pitching to him at the time, and you wanna strike out the coach. And again, we knew he played pro ball. I think he played AAA. And he says, yeah, I'm a righty, but I'm gonna bat left-handed with you guys. And he was not a switch hitter. And if you ever try to see me do anything left-handed, it is awful. Like you're gonna look at me, laugh, and ask like, have you ever walked before? It's really bad. And so he gets up there left-handed, and I was like, oh, this is gonna be easy, right? And I mean, dude just starts parking home runs, like drilling the baseball like opposite field and over walls. I'm like, he's not even a left-handed hitter, right? It's at that moment that I realized that he knew more than me and his perspective was bigger than mine. It's at that moment I realized that maybe I should wait back when the pitcher throws the baseball. Because when we talk about timing, whether it's my coach's or mine, or whether it's ours or God's, what we're talking about is, do we trust God's perspective over our own? Because it's bigger than ours. When we talk about timing, what we're asking is, why is God not delivered, and why does he deliver in the way that he delivers, and why does it happen when I think it should happen? And the simple answer for that, even though it's not that simple, is that we're not God. And the hard, difficult parts about that is sometimes it involves waiting. So we're gonna tell the story of Jesus 5, 6, 7, 8, 9,000 times as we walk this earth and we celebrate this season and we listen to boys to men together, right? We're gonna do that again and again and again. But over and over and over again, I don't wanna miss the point. But what this story reminds me of is that God knew what he was doing. And it wasn't just a happenstance of when Jesus came. He didn't get bored and say, okay, let's go now, I've had enough. From the beginning of the foundations of the world, God said, this is the time this is gonna happen because I've picked it. So when we talk about why we trust God's timing, it's because as I look back now, I see that it's perfect. And I'm sure they didn't get it then. I'm sure John the Baptist didn't. I know Mary didn't get it then. She's like, what is happening right now? But we have the ability to look back and say, I don't think this time and place has been existed before or has been repeated after. And I hope that gives us confidence in God, because here's the tough part about timing, is that we still have to trust God's timing in our lives. And every time we read this story and we see this certain set of situations that brought us to the point where we say God is good, I hope that it transfers to our tomorrow. I hope that if we have confidence in God's story of when he sent Jesus, we realize that he's still good and his timing's still perfect. Because that's a hard tension to deal with. Because I want him to deliver in my time. I could do it better. And I read these stories and realize maybe not. Because God's timing is good and he is faithful. And he says, in the fullness of time, right now is the time that I chose for this. And it is perfect. Let me pray for us. God, I'm thankful for your bigness. I'm thankful for your perspective that's greater than mine. I'm thankful for times in our year when we can sit down and tell the same stories and be reminded of your timing and your perspective. Because it's so easy to challenge that. It's so easy to say I know better. It's so easy to say that my timing would be better than God's timing. But then we read these stories and we're reminded in the past that your timing's been good, and hopefully it gives us hope for the future, that your timing will still be good tomorrow. So give us just a faith in your character, a faith in your faithfulness. Let us know and believe that you are good and that your timing is perfect. Let us know and believe and have hope, because we can look back and see that Jesus has come and he will come again in your time. And I pray these things in his name.